You pressed play on this podcast with the click of curiosity. It is another dimension, a dimension of mind, a dimension where nothing is sacred and everything is explainable. You're streaming into a land of both inside and outside, of things and ideas. You've just crossed over into the midside.
Welcome to the midside, where we may live in California, but it teaches us one thing. LA sports fans are bandwagoners. I'm your host, Justin M. Lezdeski, and of course, I'm a Boston Red Sox fan. So, as you listen to this, you will know whether I experienced disappointment or excitement at watching Game 5 of the World Series on Sunday night. We are recording before the game, but you will be listening to it after the game. Time travel, sort of. Not joining me this trip is Daniel T. Richards. He is again at a wedding. This is again not paternity leave. He's at a wedding. I believe he is officiating his second wedding in 2 weeks, which he is making no money for. But you know who is joining me? From Dale's Lawn, identifying as a woman to forgo his white male gay privilege, William Green.
Hello, hello. Yeah, I'm also not making any money this weekend. Come on, Justin, pay up.
Hey, hey, hey. We all know the Patreon money is being not touched until I leave California because I don't want them to get part of that when they try and fucking tax it. I'm not touching that money until I leave California.
Oh, man. Delayed gratification. That's what sets us ahead from, well, most of humanity.
Yeah, most of humanity. It's what makes me able to go to see the game tonight, because I can afford to pay $250 for a ticket.
I bet there'll be a steal right now, now that there's basically no chance the Dodgers could win. I bet you'll find some cheaper tickets.
Well, that is cheap. They were like $600 earlier in the week, because if you watched the game last night, so this guy, everyone listening to this right now, if you had watched the game on Saturday night, when the Red Sox went up 9-4 at the top of the ninth, all of the Dodgers fans started leaving. I was like, really? It's the World Series and you're leaving the game?
I don't really have a dog in this race. Like, I sort of mostly am cheering for Boston because I'd rather see the American League win. But you know, like, I cheered for the Dodgers last year. My team being the Tigers, of course. But the difference in the fans and the stands are absolutely amazing. Someone should do a side-by-side shot of them showing behind home plate, the ninth inning in the game that went into 18 innings versus the ninth inning in Boston, and it is amazing. The crowd is just totally different between the two stadiums.
Of course, of course. That's what I was just talking to my mother about. I was saying, if these seats were in Boston, there would not be a World Series ticket for $250. Like, are you kidding me? Are you kidding me, LA fans? And yeah. I understand that you want to support the American League, because fuck the National League, nationalistic league. No, we're the American League.
That's right. The only nationalism is Americanism.
Well, when we're talking about nationalism and Americanism, I think there's a lot that is relevant to it this week in the news. So let's get into it in the news without Daniel T. Richards.
Well, I assure you, Mr. Listener, it really is that bad. These aren't harmless criminals. This isn't just a fad.
All right. So first, thank you to all our Patreon supporters. If you'd like to be a Patreon supporter too, you can visit themidside.com/Patreon or patreon.com/themidside. And you give us, you know, $1, $2, $5 every time we publish an awesome episode of Welcome to the Midside. So if you'd like to sign up, visit the site. And don't forget, you get some secret perks if you join. So go to midside.com/Patreon or patreon.com/themidside.
And honestly, we would be okay with you giving us like a quarter, but I think the minimum Patreon lets you give is $1. So we don't care how much you give. Just support us. Thanks. Love you.
So first up, we have to cover this. What we know about the pipe bomb scare and suspect asshole douchebag arrest. Of course, you know, Midside policy is we don't spread the name of crazy people who do crazy things, because that's usually their main motivation, which is something we'll get into, I'm sure. The string of suspicious packages, most filled with explosive devices, sent to high-profile figures critical of President Trump and CNN's New York offices, have been intercepted by authorities over the past week, leading to at least one arrest on Friday. As the Secret Service and FBI continue to investigate the attempted attacks, here's everything we know about the pipe bomb scare. Who is the subject? Asshole Crazy Person, 56, a Florida resident, was taken into custody on Friday morning after police raided a home in Plantation, Florida. Authorities were seen placing a tarp over a white van with dozens of Trump pictures and decals covering the windows shortly after the arrest. The van was seized by officials and was taken to a secure facility. He was charged with interstate transportation of an explosive, illegal mailing of explosives, threats against former presidents and certain other persons, threatening interstate communications, and assaulting current and former federal officers. He faces up to 48 years in prison, authorities said during a news conference on Friday. DNA evidence taken from the packages was used to help arrest him by comparing it to other DNA authorities had on file. Crazy Person was previously arrested in Miami-Dade in 2002, where he made a bomb threat. He's a registered Republican who has lived in New York, North Carolina, Michigan, and New Jersey. So, Justin, what do you think about the news's coverage of this Crazy Person? Are we dealing with a white nationalist insurrection?
I really, 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 really wish we'd stop with the neatly defined boxes for all of these people. The other story, of course, is the guy who went into the synagogue in Pittsburgh on Saturday and killed 11 people. And that story to me is more revealing than this story of the overall issue. He was someone who he was posting a lot online, a lot of anti-Semitic comments. He really did not like Jewish people, but he was also critical of President Trump. Now, this throws a huge wrench into the narrative that was created well before the bombing suspect, but was continued with the bombing suspect, which is the idea of, oh, look, Trump and his white nationalism and his Nazi-esque rhetoric and his Nazi-esque approach to politics, because Trump is a Nazi, Trump is Hitler, is encouraging and inciting violence. Meanwhile, let's ignore Antifa and everything they've been doing since, you know, before the election. We'll just ignore that. But that's the narrative they've been preaching, really. This is religious fervor. We've talked about that before, how this rhetoric is very religious. But what this really is a mental health issue. One of the greatest problems facing humanity is taking mental health seriously. We don't take our physical health seriously enough. It was something Dr. Drew talks about. Is he talks about the difference between fitness and health. We still haven't even crossed that gap yet as a culture, let alone mental health. Something that I wish Daniel was on the show this week, because something that Daniel says all the time that I agree with is everyone should have a yearly mental health checkup as well. But we don't even have the infrastructure for that. You or I, William, we can't go in and get a yearly mental health checkup. We can't just do one appointment. They haven't even developed a system for that the way they've developed a physical. And that's how you end up with things like this. These people are falling through the gap of society and ending up committing violence against other people. You know, there's some debate as to whether the bombs were actually designed to go off or not. I don't know about that. But the guy, the Pittsburgh guy, definitely murdered 11 people. And then I'm putting Antifa in the same category. Antifa is out there committing violence. I see videos on Twitter all the time of them committing violence, of them just getting in the streets and directing traffic and attacking people. These are people with severe mental health issues, and we're normalizing it and saying that it's not mental health, especially Antifa. We're saying, oh, that's their right to free speech.
Well, only Antifa has a right to free speech. After CNN blamed Gab, one of the Twitter alternatives dedicated to free speech, for the synagogue shooter, PayPal dropped them. Their hosting company dropped them. Gab had to migrate to a new host. Thankfully, the internet being the internet, there were something like 10 or 15 hosting companies that jumped up and said, "Hey, move to us. Like, we got you." This is really unfair. But now Gab is being portrayed as a white nationalist or a home for racists, right? Like think of the implication here. They're doing the same thing again. They're saying, hey, Gab has, there are, since it's dedicated to free speech, of course there are some sleazy and awful and racist people there, right? But we're going to paint the whole platform as that. And it's we're seeing it over and over again, this tribalism and this frozen abstraction of taking one person and taking all their attributes and applying it to the entire group. It's mind-boggling. Like, it's so easy to see once you know to look for it, but the fact that it's happening over and over, this, it's much deeper than guilt by association, right? It's you are that, basically they're treating Gab as if they were facilitating this murder, right? Like they were an accessory in this murder.
You said it though, William. I don't know if you realized you said it, but you revealed the true agenda underneath all of this. And it's the unfair, dishonest association of free speech with white nationalism. They want people to associate the fact that if we have, this is what they want people to believe, that if we have completely free speech, if we have completely unregulated speech, we will have white nationalism. That is what they want people to believe.
I'm here to tell you that is true. You know what? If we have free speech, we're going to have some nasty, terrible, awful, evil things being said. But you know what else will happen? We will also have good things being said, and we'll have people engaging people and talking to people and arguing and having a arena of ideas. But you know what's going to happen if we deplatform everyone who doesn't fit into the social justice hierarchy? It's going to be violence, because when there's not a place for words, the only alternative left is violence.
Right, and that's the irony they don't realize in their... Well, no, I would argue they realize it, actually. And here's the thing. Everything you just said is 100% correct. But what they want people to believe is that necessarily the dominating voice will be white nationalism and Nazism if free speech is allowed, which is a fucked up view of the world. Their two views of the world they're creating are either you let us be in control, or with no one in control, they're the ones who end up in control.
And yeah, Justin, I think that's the point, though, is it's control. That is right, what no, this is after. The thing that they're rejecting is the creative destruction that comes with a free and capitalistic society, right? The idea that, you know what, there have been white nationalists in this country for, you know, at least since the Jim Crow era and the reaction to that, right? And probably even before that, right? Back into the Civil War era and before. But the ebb and flow of bad ideas is that you bring them out to the light of day, and you're right, with good arguments, I'm not saying it's automatic, but with good arguments against it, then it doesn't ever gain any traction. It doesn't become a movement. But right now, the way that the political correctness and this speech codifying is going, it's like they're taking what we would consider in a healthy society manners, and they're trying to make them, instead of how to be polite and how to have civil conversations, it's that they're defining it in such black and white terms on their terms that any speech outside of their acceptable speech is violence and should be stopped by any means necessary, including things like deplatforming, or in this case, delete platforming, right? Remove the platform that the evil folk are using, right? Now, I agree that these individuals we're talking about in these news stories are evil, but the problem is they out of the one user, of the millions of users of Gab, that's the person, like that one person now represents all of Gab, and so you shut it off? It doesn't make any sense.
Well, right, because there are other ways of identifying that these people are issues, and it's the mental health route. These people have issues, and then they're the problem. You don't throw out the baby with the bathwater because you find one drop of unhealthy contaminated water. And that's what we're doing right now. But they're doing it, William, because they know this is all force, and they know this is all violence, because ultimately when you're using government to get into power and control people and limit things, you're speaking the language of force. So they see the, as I've said many times before, they see the world as oppressor and oppressed. So they are just going to make themselves into the oppressor so they're not the oppressed. That is the way they view the world. And that is the what they're trying to tell people.
Well, you know, it's hard for me to stand the fact that we know that there is a mental health issue, and the lens that the media always put this in is a political lens. And rather than looking at this problem and saying, wow, the police knew this guy was a bomber, wasn't he being tracked? Like, what does the FBI do, right? Like, they were pretty quick at identifying this person, right? They had his freaking DNA, right? How does this even happen on that side? I know that the story is still being uncovered on the synagogue bomber, but the fact that both of these folks were anti-Semite, one of them hated Trump for supposedly he's part of the Jewish cabal or whatever. The fact that the media is constantly amplifying these sort of white nationalist tropes and then pointing to something like Gab and saying, look, these people are evil. Like it's crazy, right? How many of these news organizations are spreading these guys' message all around the world? And it's the irony is just not obvious to them, and it's obvious to us.
That's because we're geniuses.
Well, one of us is.
I know. I mean, thank you for that compliment. That's really humbling to receive such a compliment. I appreciate that.
Well, speaking of people doing a great job moving around and being geniuses, the migrant caravan is a right-wing fever dream, says Justin Charity from The Ringer. And Donald Trump is using it as a wedge issue in the midterms. Dun, dun, dun. Over the past month, a caravan that departed Honduras on foot has grown to include 7,000 people. Many of them have responded to a flyer inviting them to gather at a bus station in northwestern Honduras. And a bunch of Spanish that I'm not going to read that translates to, we're not leaving because we want to. Violence and poverty have forced us out. Honduras is plagued by gang violence and political corruption, so these people fled north. The migrants are marching more than 1,000 miles through Mexico City. Currently, they're approaching Mexico City from the south. The news media has circulated photos of the marchers clogging city streets and highways. The photos are striking. They show a peaceful mobilization of people in street clothes, many of them women and children, embarked in a long and haphazard journey through the unfamiliar territory and toward a perilous political end. In these photos, Trump sees a specter of Western decline. He sees the exact sort of people who contemptuous immigration policies are designed to repel. The U.S. Defense Secretary Jim Mattis is dispatching 800 soldiers to join the 2,100 National Guard troops, plus regular patrol forces stationed at the southern U.S. border. To those in the caravan, Donald Trump tweeted Thursday afternoon, turn around. We are not letting people in the United States illegally. Go back to your country if you want. Apply for citizenship like millions of others are doing. If the caravan is indeed bound for the U.S., currently the itinerary is unclear, the march may culminate with an unprecedented standoff between thousands of immigrants from Central America and thousands of armed forces from the United States. So, Justin, this article is interesting read into the social justice mind. Do you see some grand romantic stand with a bunch of armed officers in a tank not letting people into our country, basically the opposite of Tiananmen Square? Is that what's going to happen?
Oh, William, this is where things get so difficult when it's a narrative and it's not reporting the reality of the situation, because the narrative overtakes the reality and we don't know what is really going on and what the real issues are. Because I can see this. I can see this in my mind, and it scares the shit out of me. What happens if this caravan shows up at our border and we have armed troops there and one crazy person tries to run through and he gets shot and it becomes chaos? Does this not almost seem like, I think of 28 weeks later at the beginning where they're trying to keep people contained, and then they can't, and all hell just breaks loose. That's what I think of. So, yeah, they push this narrative, but is that really is what's going to happen? I don't know. I understand what these people are leaving and how terrible the conditions are in their country, but here's the thing. I get the principle of open immigration and open borders, but can that really mean just letting everyone in? Can that really mean that if there's a caravan, yeah, as you're saying, hold on, I know you're going to have a response. I'm setting you up. So let me set you up. If there's a caravan, like, this is worst case scenario. Like you're saying, this is like a movie. It's like someone wrote a fucking movie and there's a caravan coming. Does it really mean just let everyone in? There has to be some sort of screening process. And then the other side to continue with that is, well, then does it ever realistically work to have open borders and open immigration? So what does that really mean? Because I think that's really what we have to grapple with when we're looking at this. Because we can't just fucking 10,000 people show up and say, let us in, and we let them in. I know Eric Garcetti is trying to say that's a drop in the bucket. It's not going to affect us, but that does affect us.
Yeah, I think it comes down to my three favorite words. False dichotomy, bro. This is a media circus, and I'm not sure it does anything for either side. As far as like giving either the Democrats or the Republicans advantage, but enough inside baseball. What should happen in real life here is these folks, they should come to the border. They should be processed. And if they're not criminals, sick or terrorists, they should be let in. Right. That's me. That's what I think. Now, that's not the law currently. And the law currently is if they want to apply for citizenship, they have to apply for citizenship. If they want to get a visa to visit, they have to apply for a visa to visit. Or, you know, you do it on a plane every time I visit another country. What this is a way to keep people distracted and thinking about immigration. And the media is just feeding off of it. I don't think this is... People are using this as an indictment against us in America and America's immigration policies. And I think there's a lot of room to improve with our immigration policies. But isn't this really an indictment against Honduras? Like 10,000 people want to leave all at once? Like, what the hell is going on down there?
Yes, William, this is altruism in action. And what I mean by that is exactly as you're saying, all of these fucking people are leaving Honduras, and I'm sure other countries on their way up, they're all joining. And who do they expect to carry the burden of their fuck ups? Now, I'm not calling the people coming here fuck ups. If they can literally walk that far and survive and get here, you know, they're strong people and good for them. I'm calling the country a fuck up. So they're fucking up. And then what's happening as a result is they're saying, oh, America can handle it. They're successful. They'll take care of all our problems. Here's the overrun of our problems. You take care of them. You make this work. So now, because we're living in a global society, it is our responsibility as an altruistic nation to make other people's irrationalities work. We have to cover up for their mistakes. It's literally like we as a country need to go to Al-Anon. Al-Anon is Dr. Drew talks about it all the time. It's like Alcoholics Anonymous, but it's for people who are friends or have relationships with people who are addicts. And you go there to learn how to properly deal with them. And one of them is not to what's the word? I can't think of it right now. Enable. We are enabling these other countries by doing this. And I know it sounds harsh and it sounds cold to be like, we can't take these people in to enable these other countries. That's what happens when shitty people, evil people get in control.
Yeah, I don't think we're going to get the comic scene of 10,000 people trying to show up to the border at once. I think that what will actually happen is most of these folks will stay in Mexico. Mexico is bad, but definitely sounds better than Honduras. I think that if we had some real real consistent, non-hypocritical leaders of companies that were all into the social justice movement, they would be sponsoring visas for these work visas for some of these folks, right? Like they'd be sending people down to interview. They'd be down saying, we've got jobs for you up here. But, you know, we're not going to see that. What's going to happen is some of these folks are going to stay in Mexico City. Some of them are going to stay in other parts of Mexico. If people do come to the border and have legitimate asylum applications or asylum reasons and applications, remember, economic hardship is currently not recognized as a reason for asylum seeking. Then maybe some of these folks get processed and brought into the country. But I think if we're moving more towards a principled immigration policy, I think I've mentioned this on a show, man, it must have been last year or a couple years ago when I was guest hosting. For me, it's super easy. The principle is super easy to explain. I, as an American citizen, have a right to trade with whoever I want. And that includes people walking their way north through Mexico from Honduras. And if those folks want to come here and engage in trade, take part in our capitalist adventure here in the United States, I am all for it. The problem, of course, is that in states, especially in California and other states, people are a way for the government to extract more money from the people who create it, i.e. the businessmen. And they're just a political coin that folks like Garcetti cash every election season, not necessarily at the polls, but as a scapegoat, as a sort of Mother Teresa figure of, we have to take care of these people. And that's how they use that white guilt, that liberal guilt to as a sort of club in the elections. So how do you unwind this situation? I think is really complex, and I'm not exactly sure how to do it. But if I look at the 10,000 foot view, like the solution here is a consistent and principled immigration policy saying, you know what? We know we can't process everyone who wants to come here, so we're going to try. Here's the criteria we're going to use, and have that criteria and say, hey, if you want to come here and be a permanent resident, this is the criteria. Let's apply it consistently. And you know what? Let's let businesses who pay so much in taxes get priority over some of these work visas and get them processed. Like let's take all the restrictions in country of origin and the sort of guild control of which jobs are allowed to have work visas and which ones aren't to get permanent residency status. Let's get rid of all that cruft and get down to the business of business here in the US and get people here that want to come here. I think it's great that people want to come here. Those are the people I want here. There's tons of people in Hollywood who want to live in Canada. So let's replace them with some of these Hondurans.
That's funny. Can we do the Honduran Hollywoodian exchange program?
Yeah,
can
we that? Should do an exchange program. Absolutely. Send them down there. There's more socialism down there. So they'll be in their paradise, these Hollywood folks. All right. Speaking of Hollywood and liberals, we've got a news story out of San Francisco. This comes from Zero Hedge. Tyler Durden, of course, our favorite Zero Hedge author. San Francisco's new app, Snapcrap, lets users report public feces. I think we've mentioned this on the show before. There was an old app that did this a couple years ago, but now there's a new one that's all up to date. So the city of San Francisco now has a new app that allows users to report poop in public places. The city, under complete totalitarian leftist control, has a large homeless population thanks to unaffordable housing and the high cost of living in the city. Created by tech-savvy resident, the Snapcrap app allows users to take photos of errant public human feces and send those photos to city management using the city's 311 information hotline, which serves as San Francisco's official poop reporting phone number. According to the Daily Wire, Sean Miller, the app's creator, told NBC's local affiliate that he was inspired to launch the poop reporting system after moving to San Francisco and finding himself forced to step over human waste lying in the middle of city sidewalks, a phenomenon he hadn't experienced in his home state of Vermont. The city of San Francisco approves the app's creation. One of city manager told NBC that Any way people want to report concerns and service requests to us, that's great. City officials stress that they are trying to get ahead of the problem of poop all over the city. They also say that incidents in need of immediate attention should be reported directly to the city's 311 hotline, which dispatches the city's so-called poop patrol. One of the most expensive places to live in the globe, San Francisco has been bombarded with fecal matter that they cannot seem to control. So, Justin, do you think the city will, with this new poop app, will they be able to push back the poop?
No, this is how the leftists always try to slap band-aids on these problems they've created with their overarching policies. And they think that that's going to fix it. Like, this is more of a PR thing than anything. Oh, if we let the tech savvy people of Silicon Valley feel like they're using tech to solve the problem, it will make them feel better. How are you going to do this when there are still people wandering around pooping on the streets? You're going to clean up crap by an app when there are people still out there crapping on the streets?
Yeah, I don't think this is going to work either. I think, and I'm a little disappointed in our friend Tyler Durden here saying that the homeless problem in San Francisco is because of it's an expensive place to live. You know where else is an expensive place to live? Manhattan. And while there might be occasional trash in Manhattan, I don't remember walking over poop constantly. And I was just in San Francisco and I did see some poop.
Well, there is a difference of weather. I want to be clear about that. Although San Francisco isn't that great.
Yeah, San Francisco you definitely could die of exposure in San Francisco in the winter. It does get cold enough for that. But it was probably 4 months ago that I was in San Francisco, but even just where I work in Santa Monica, there are tents all lined along this warehouse building. I have to drive by it every day. And all I can think of is these folks, it gets back to our mental health issue. Homelessness is not caused by not having a home. I know that sounds really weird to say, but that's not the cause of homelessness, right? It's an effect of mental health problems or psychological problems, right? The fact that people want to live this way, right? It's different. The fact that someone, even if they don't have a home, would want to live or be forced to live in a tent by a warehouse shows that they have no family support structure. They have no friend support structure. And it shows a psychological, at the very least, and probably a mental health issue. I think I've told this story before. I can set my watch by the poor homeless woman that pushes a cart by the 24-hour fitness gym. She's arguing with the cart. She gets angry at the cart and kicks it over, yells at it some more, and then about 45 minutes later comes back, apologizes to the cart, picks it up out of the dirt, and then pushes it the rest of the way around 24-hour fitness. We have a mental health problem, not a homeless problem. The homeless problem is caused by the mental health problem. We have drugs and mental health that are causing this problem, and that's where we need to attack this problem. It's not unaffordable housing, although that is certainly true. The amount of control that San Francisco has over who can build and what they can build and the amount of time. It takes something like 16 months to get a permit to do any building in San Francisco, and it costs thousands and thousands of dollars. Like, yes, there is a housing problem too, but these are all downstream of the actual problem.
Yeah, 100%. I mean, when you say drugs and mental health, these two things reinforce each other, right? They're like they're a cycle that reinforces each other.
Exactly.
Because who knows how either gets started with the mental health or the drugs, but they lead into each other and then they keep reinforcing each other cyclically. And look, I know I'm an objectivist. I know we're syndicated on liberty.me. I tend to identify as a libertarian, but mental health, I tend to think that that's something that it's worth the government getting involved in. And maybe that's a legitimate use of government, because when these people become this way, it becomes a safety issue. There's issues of violence. There's issues of disease. So this, I don't know, William, is there a way that this isn't a government issue?
Yeah, I think that Dr. Drew has sometimes pointed this out, and I'd certainly defer to him on this. But the fact that the laws have changed in how we treat mental health And the fact that you can't put someone in, like if someone is suicidal, you can put them on a short-term watch. But basically outside of that, it's really hard to get the state involved and say, hey, this person, you know, has a bad enough, is currently in a bad enough mental state that they cannot be allowed to make decisions for themselves, right? In other words, they do not have the power of decision-making, right? That's a hard thing to get right. But right now it is too hard to get people the mental health they need, because it does require some force. When people are in these psychotic states or in bipolar states, like these kinds of manic and depressive states, they aren't operating in a way that will allow them to get help themselves. And I think it's a difficult issue. I'm not, it'd be great if we could, if someone could hop on Discord and talk to us about the laws of California, what they would do to improve the ability for the state and private charities to respond to this. Because even private charities, they have no power, which is good in general. They have no power to like hold people there for treatment, right? But instead, what San Francisco does, instead of building a mental health facility, they build a drug den, right? Like that we covered that story, I think. There's a place where people can go shoot up their drugs in San Francisco. Shouldn't that be a mental health facility instead? It makes no sense to me.
I don't have anything to add. I think you're spot on, William.
Well, let's get a little more lighthearted rather than poop on
more?
The streets.
Yeah, I don't know
a little
if this
more
is lighthearted.
A men's rights activist sued a women's beer event. How men rights activists are able to keep exploiting civil rights laws. This is from The Vox, Rebecca Jennings. In 2011, Ting Su, the co-founder of Eagle Rock Brewery in Los Angeles, launched a monthly event for women interested in beer. The aim was to balance out the overwhelmingly male and white beer world, where, Su said, men often feel entitled to interject their own opinions when women customers asked women bartenders like her for recommendations. The Women's Beer Forum was a space where the women would outnumber the men while discussing craft beer, a rarity. But in November 2017, Su tells Eater, a man emailed Eagle Rock's general information line asking for a spot at the ticketed forum. A staff member mistakenly told the man that the event was for women only. In fact, men have attended before. And even after he was offered access to a future women's beer event, the man ultimately filed a discrimination claim through the Department of Fair Employment and Housing, the entity in charge of enforcing California's civil rights laws. The man is Stephen Fry, a men's rights activist, or MRA, who is hardly a stranger to filing discrimination cases against California businesses and, at one point, Donald Trump. In 2011, Fry sued one of Trump's golf courses because it offered a 25% discount to ladies for Breast Cancer Awareness Month. It's just one of dozens of other lawsuits he filed for ladies' night specials or deals for women. Men's rights activists believe that society is actually sexist against men, and Fry has perfected the subculture's favorite way to target what they see as societies that are sexist against men, suing businesses and organizations that incentivize women to go there. So I want to skip a little bit because I love the end of this article. The weaponization of this law against the very philosophy that one claims to champion is a case study in irony. For MRAs, it's able-bodied, white, cis, heterosexual men using civil rights legislation, which is enacted to walk back the country's history of viewing the rights of able-bodied, white, cis, heterosexual men as more important than others, to penalize the very kinds of people these laws were meant to protect. And for free speech advocates, it's policing any discourse they don't agree with. MRAs have an inherently reactionary philosophy. The subculture arose out of anger toward a society they feel have become too open, too welcoming, too equal. When the law is set up to protect all people, regardless of their demographic, these kinds of bad faith actors are able to twist laws designed to help correct imbalances, to try and undermine their existence. And if the rising interest in men rights activists and adjacent ideologies, incels, the alt-right, white supremacists, is any indication, these kinds of lawsuits are likely only to continue. Justin, this article is amazing. I love this article. What part of this twisted logic first triggered you as you were reading through this article?
Oh, William, this article, you shared it, and I was like, that's great pod. This is perfect. This is exactly what we're talking about on this show. So there's a lot of farce we talked about this episode, but this article is the farce of all farce. Let's start right at the beginning. You asked the question, what first triggered me? It's the beginning where, remember everyone out there, remember ladies and gentlemen, remember insiders, I'm straight edge. So the article starts from the premise of craft brewing and craft beers is a culture that is too dominated by white males. So we need to get some diversity inside of craft brewing. What? So you're telling me you hate white males because we control everything. And then one of our hobbies is something that's self-destructive. And you're like, you know what? Let's get in on that self-destruction. It's like suicide packs. Too many white males have suicide packs. Where are the non-gendered, non-binary, racially diverse suicide packs? Oh, we need to have more of those and fewer white male suicide packs. That's essentially what you're saying. And it's so twisted. The idea that, hey, they're pouring chemicals into their body that hurt their kill their body and alter their perception of reality. Let's get in on that. Then it gets to the end of this article. And as you just read, when you read that, I didn't hear any logic. I just heard fucking buzzwords. Incels, manosphere, Nazism, alt-right. It's just the example of these specters that they've raised up. Wouldn't you want all of these incels and white nationalists and Nazis and manospheres, if they're poisoning themselves, wouldn't you let them? Wouldn't you encourage it?
I encourage all of our listeners to go to themidside.com/podcast and read this article, because it is so, every part of this is just twisted logic. It's amazing. They even bring in Jordan Peterson in the middle paragraphs saying that he must be hypocritical because he's an advocate for free speech, but then files a defamation lawsuit for being called alt-right.
This is literally, William, this is the other thing that you just pointed out that is farcical that I haven't even mentioned yet. This exposes how absurd these laws are. These laws are fucking stupid social justice laws that don't have anything really to do with justice. And now that they're being used against them, they don't like it. It's like, what the fuck did you think was going to happen? You opened the ball to the, you opened the court to this. And because other people are bringing their ball and playing on the court, you don't like it?
Yeah, I think that's a great point, Justin. Just to be clear, I think that you should not, that the government should not discriminate based on sex, gender, religion, all sorts of things, right? They should not discriminate on any of those things. But individuals should be free to discriminate on whatever they want. And if they make the wrong choice, if they discriminate against the wrong group, or make up a group and discriminate against them, they should pay the consequences in the market. That's the way things should work. Now, that's how the law should be, right? Now, if someone's going to have, I'm okay with someone having a ladies' night at a bar and giving people a discount for that. I think that's fine. But the way this law is written, that's not so fine. And the fact that people are pointing that out and filing suit to protect against it is evidence that the law should be repealed, not that MRAs are somehow evil. And it's so crazy, too, to paint this. Like, I am, as a business owner, I'm no fan of these people who go around suing people because of the corrupt California laws. You know, I'm in constant fear that someone is going to try and file some ADA lawsuit where I have to pay tons of money to defend myself, right? That's a thing that small business owners all have to fear. So I'm not a huge fan of this, but at the same time, I understand where this is coming from. If we're going to set a rule, let's follow it, is sort of view of some of these folks. And in some cases, this is extremely good, right? Right now, Harvard's being sued because of their discrimination against Asians and whites. The California college system, despite the proposition that says they cannot discriminate based on race, continues to do so. And the numbers show that out in attendance. I mean, Asian attendance has gone up, but they're still people who have comparable objective scores, whether that be tests, grades, other things, are still not let in over preferred racial candidates, right? In the oppression Olympics, and so we know it's still happening here in California. So I think this is really an interesting window into the mind of social justice. The fact that all groups that they define, except for white cis heterosexual males, are allowed to fight against oppression, but those folks are not, because they are part of the patriarchy. And that means that their group is the out group, and their tribe is the bad tribe, and we must not let them assert any of their rights.
Yeah, you just said the key words in there. It's something I said in the beginning. It's their whole narrative that there can only be oppressor and oppressed. And they've decided the cis hetero white males are the oppressor. So they're never allowed to defend themselves.
And as someone who has totally struck up a conversation at the bar talking about beer, not necessarily to pick up a dude, but I'm sure that, you know, people do that. Like, I'm sure there are heterosexual people who pick up chicks by talking about beer at the bar. Doesn't the beginning of this article sound a lot like the who was that poor actor that had an awkward sexual encounter? Isn't this like a lesser version of that? Like, someone goes up to someone at the bar and starts talking, trying to strike up a conversation about beer. The woman interprets it as mansplaining and then starts her own like beer support group or something. Like, it just seems it seems like victimhood on steroids.
Well, 100% is, and that's what I was saying to you is. Ultimately, it's a question of where are our values at and how good is our society if that's what we're worried about. There's too much white male representation in beer. You got it pretty fucking good then, lady. You got it pretty fucking good if that's what you're worried about.
Yep, I'm still waiting for the affirmative action and diversity inclusion plan for the sanitation workers in L.A. I'm still waiting for that.
Come on.
It's too male and it's too Hispanic, so I don't know why we're not challenging that. We need more women. I want to see red haired. I want to see that triggered lady that was on her knees with the high visibility vest screaming during the Trump election. I want to see her behind the wheel of a trash truck. I want to see more pink haired feminists behind the wheel and operating the machinery to pick up my trash. It's unfair It's unfair that those groups are not represented in the folks that pick up my trash.
I don't disagree with you. I don't disagree with you. And when we're talking about what we like seeing, I think that's a perfect segue into our next segment. So thank you, William, for that segue. Let's head into the Hopeful Romantic with JML. I start this segment with a review, but if you want to hear other Patreon exclusive reviews, then you should sign up to be a Patreon supporter. Any amount will get you exclusive reviews of movies such as The Last Jedi, Solo, A Star Wars Story. Spoiler, it was terrible. What was the VR one we did, William?
The VR one? Based on the book. Ready Player One.
Ready Player One. Yeah. So we reviewed a bunch of movies like that. We're going to continue doing that. It's been a little touch and go since MoviePass went down, but I'm probably going to sign up for the AMC Pass, the $20 a month one, to start going to see any more movies again. So sign up at patreon.com/themidside, themidside.com/Patreon if you want Patreon exclusive movie reviews from our panel of Midsiders. This week's review, William, have you ever seen Big Mouth on Netflix?
No, I haven't.
Now, I don't know if I've talked about this show before. I don't know if I've reviewed it before. But my girlfriend and I started watching season 2. And it's so good that even if I talked about it before, I want to talk about it again. So episode 2 is a body positive episode. And I know, wait. This is the midside. Why are we talking about body positivity? Because one of the things when we've talked about before is good body positivity versus bad body positivity, correct?
Yeah.
What would you say the difference is between those two? What's good body positivity and bad body positivity?
Well, I guess for me, good body positivity, the concrete example I can give is when I look at myself, I know that I have a little bit more fat than is probably healthy. But I also know that I go to the rock climbing gym and I go on hikes with my dog. I'm in pretty good damn shape. I'm pretty strong. So for me, it's about looking at my body objectively and saying, hey, these are areas that I can improve in my health, and these are areas where I'm good in my health. And I feel good about what I can do. The fact that I can do like 6 pull-ups is like, for me, a big deal. So I like that. So I try to celebrate the good things about my body, and I try to gain perspective on the things that I may not like.
The celebration and the gaining perspective are great. The key word, though, there is objectively. And what this episode hones in on is the objective approach to accepting what you can't control about your genetics. So this entire episode of season two, roll back a little bit. The entire show is about puberty. It's about kids who are just entering puberty.
Gross.
They have these hormone monsters. Well, that's the thing. Like, you would think it'd be gross, but it's very well done. They have hormone monsters that only they can see, which are controlling them and making them go crazy and do ridiculous things. And for this girl in this episode, she's going crazy and her hormone monster is making her feel super insecure because this other girl developed boobs before everyone else and all the guys liked her, but she doesn't have any boobs yet. And she has to learn to accept that she can't control that. That genetically, she's going to have a certain body type, and she's going to have to accept that. Now, I do wish in the episode, William, they had done the gym thing like you said. I don't think when the body positivity conversation happens with kids, and you know, even adults, but kids especially, they say, okay, well, that's the body you're born with, but it's also clay that you can mold. So there's a certain, you know, skeleton literally to it that you can't change. There's an infrastructure that you can't change, but you can do a lot to mold it. I wish been addressed in the episode, but this wasn't about like, oh, hey, you're fat, except being fat. It was literally the unchangeable is the unchangeable. And it was handled in a very humorous and creative way. I think this is one of the best shows going on any platform. I was going to say on television, but you can't say that anymore, on any platform going. So I would highly recommend Big Mouth. You know, if you enjoyed South Park, if you enjoy Bob's Burgers, it's right in that sort of vein. Of course, if it's animated, so if you hate animation, you're not going to like it. So just don't watch it if you hate animation. Anything to add, William?
No, I think that's a great point. I think I'll put it in my Netflix queue.
Yeah, definitely. Season one is great, but season two has been even better so far. So check it out. We're about to move on to Trailer Takedown now. And if you want to watch the trailers before the episode starts, during the episode, you can always watch them on the midside.com/podcast. I usually post them between Thursday and Saturday. And some people I know like to watch them before the episode. Some people like to, as I just said, we talk about a trailer, they pause it, they watch the next one. We talk about a trailer, they pause it, they watch the next one. So the midside.com/podcast for Trailer Takedown Preview.
Trailer Takedown. First trailer.
Cold Pursuit is another Liam Neeson revenge story. In this one, his son is found dead of a heroin overdose, or a alleged heroin overdose. That's what the coroner says. But Liam Neeson says, no, I'm Liam Neeson, and because I'm his father, I know more about him than you do, and he wasn't a druggie. So I am going to hunt down the gangsters who killed him and get my revenge. And it's called Cold Pursuit because this all takes place somewhere cold. I'm not sure. For some reason, I said in my head Alaska. But it's like on the fringes where he works a job where he works by himself in the cold. That's it. It's very similar to Taken. It's very similar to any Liam Neeson revenge film. But you know what? I have a whole shitload of Steven Seagal DVDs. I like a guy who, you know what the movie's about. You know what he's going to do. I like these revenge. I like these fighting back. I like these martial arts. And Liam Neeson is the 2010 version of Steven Seagal in the 80s. So I'm going to be here for any of these movies. Hug. William?
Yeah, I agree with you. This is a romantic, not in the way we usually mean, but in the sort of like romantic movement, the emotionalist camp side of things. I think it's a healthy indulgence. I'll just put it that way. A nice revenge flick to see that all played out and the consequences of that. It looks fun. It looks interesting. Lots of action. Looks like there'll be some maybe some explosions/guns. I'm in. Hug.
Yeah, and that's a more sort of in the weeds point, a very esoteric point you just made there, William, about romanticism. Romanticism originally was about just the emotional celebration of life. It's become more than that, especially in Rand's interpretation of it in the Romantic Manifesto. And the interpretation we use of romanticism is almost romantic realism, as she called it, although I aesthetically don't always prefer the realism. But that's more towards the romanticism of celebrating humanity as rational, because romanticism, when it was originally began, humans were seen as very emotional, carnal creatures, correct?
Yeah. The original romanticism is all about the sort of like rejection of the status quo, this sort of emotional outpouring, a response to the rational side, sort of the separation of magic and science, right? The separation of religion and politics. As we separated these things out, we sort of we fell into a trap of mind-body dichotomy, and the romantics originally were a response to that on the body side, right? But as we know, that's a false dichotomy. Man is both mind and body. So the fact that we have emotions is good and is necessary, and sometimes it's good to just celebrate that emotional side constrained by a good plot. And that's what I think this movie's going to be.
Yeah, and that's the important thing to remember, is in romantic realism and healthy romanticism and proper romanticism, as we talk about it, there is still a role for those emotions. And notice how the good romanticists are still rebelling against the status quo. I mean, when you look at a Snyder and a Nolan, their movies, Rodriguez, I mean, Machete, right? Let's use Robert Rodriguez and Machete. Is that movie not rebelling against the status quo?
Yeah.
Is that movie not romanticism? Yes, but that is romanticism. It's principally based. There's a principle behind all of it. And then there is the emotional, physical body manifestation in that, in the action of that movie. Actually, that's a great comparison, because I would say this movie may be similar to Machete in that way.
Yeah.
Second trailer.
Vox Lux is the story of a pop star starring Natalie Portman and Jude Law. And to be honest, I don't really know what else happens in this movie. All I was thinking was, did this get greenlit before or after the remake of A Star is Born? Because it seems very similar. It's also getting awards buzz. I mean, Natalie Portman does look like she's acting a lot in this movie. She's acting pretty hard. I love to say that. She's acting pretty hard. Because contextually, that could be like she's trying to act like she's tough. But also, it's like she's putting in a lot of effort. And you don't usually say that with acting. Or at least she has an accent in this movie. She has an accent. Does that mean she's a good actor? I don't know. Is she a good actress because she has an accent on in this movie?
I don't know. It depends on what accent. It could be cultural appropriation.
Well, that's the thing. I mean, she's not from Brooklyn, is she? It sounds like a New York Brooklyn accent. So is that cultural appropriation? Or because they're Italian and white, it's not appropriation? Aren't there Jewish people in Brooklyn? This is very confusing to me. The reason I'm talking about all of this is I don't know what this movie's about. There's nothing interesting about it. This seems fucking pretentious. I'm out. Tackle.
Yeah, pretentious naturalism is the entire vibe I got during this preview, so no fucking way. Tackle.
Oh, yeah, you say naturalism. That reminded me. The fucking shot they had in the movie is the new thing in naturalism, and I think it's from Birdman, but when they're behind the person and you see the back of their head and the back of their shoulders and you're, like, walking down a hall with them, that's in this movie. It was in A Star is Born, and it was also in First Man. So that's like the new in vogue naturalistic directing, naturalistic visualization. I think it's from Birdman.
Final trailer.
Bird Box is a Netflix original movie based on a book about a world where monsters take over, and if you see them, you are so horrified that you immediately kill yourself. This stars Sandra Bullock and a host of other talented actors and actresses. To me, it's reminiscent of The Happening, if you remember that, where people just randomly started killing themselves horrifically. but other people have drawn comparisons to A Quiet Place. I included this for two reasons. The first reason is this seems like a movie Netflix is trying to push to get themselves some awards buzz. I guess they're putting it in film or in theaters for a short run so the film can be eligible for the awards season, which is different because usually Netflix original movies are like the ones we saw where the guy's dick got cut off and then they ran around trying to get the dick back to him so it could be reattached. So there's, you know, there's the dick box and now there's the bird box, and we see how they're approaching both of them differently. So it's interesting that Netflix is trying to get that recognition. And that also will obviously shift the industry. If these online streaming companies can, if one of them can win an Academy Award, that changes the game big time. So that's the first thing, because, you know, Amazon's pushing for that as well. So that's the first thing. And the second thing is, William, I included this because this is a sci-fi movie. Or it's soft sci-fi, or however you want to say it. But I would put this under the category of science fiction. Maybe it's fantasy. But this seems like it would be up your alley. So I wanted to see what you would think about this movie. For me, this is a movie that it actually makes me want to see A Quiet Place more. Because there are two movies about similar subjects. And I want to see how they're done differently by both talents, by both creative visions. I want to see what the different creative visions are. But because this is free on Netflix, well, free, I have Netflix, I'm more likely to see this than to go to theaters. I don't think I would, if this was in theaters, I don't think I would see it. But because it's on Netflix, I'm more likely to see it. So I may actually sit down and have a double feature one day of A Quiet Place and Bird Box. Oh, the reason this is similar, oh, did I say this at the beginning? The reason it's similar to A Quiet Place is, unlike A Quiet Place where you can't talk, this one you have to cover yourself with a blindfold because if you see these monsters, you go crazy and kill yourself. So in A Quiet Place, you can't talk because if they hear you, they hunt by sound. So it's similar in that way where one of your senses are gone and there's a monster hunting you using one of those senses. But as I was saying, I would see this only because it's on Netflix. So William.
You know, the entire time I was watching this preview, I was thinking, was this a Black Mirror episode that they decided to make into a movie because they got Sandra Bullock?
Yeah, I can see that.
I think that this looks interesting to me. I think I will watch it. I'll put it in my Netflix queue. The preview is well done. It gets the premise across great, and I'm cautiously optimistic to see it. You know my view on sci-fi. I'm dying for it, and also particularly very picky about it. So, but this looks like an interesting premise to see play out, and that's the key to good sci-fi. So I'm going to give it a hug.
Hug.
Yeah, it's interesting you say the Black Mirror comparison, because I think the difference between a movie like this and a difference between the movie like Black Mirror is that or a show like Black Mirror, I think Black Mirror is trying more to explore the depths of the premise, whereas I think this movie is more sort of, as you were just saying with the Liam Neeson Cold Pursuit movie, it's more about the emotional immediacy of and physical immediacy of what would happen if this world existed. Do you get what I mean with the difference?
Yep. Well, before we leave The Hopeful Romantic, I wanted to get your quick comment on the fact that reportedly Apu is going to be banished from The Simpsons.
I mean, they're leftist pussies. Anything that I ever said positive about them, any goodwill they had built up towards me with their mocking of social justice warriors in those few episodes, I take back. I mean, that's just... it's incredibly disappointing to see that.
And I have to say, South Park called it. Their last episode was called The Problem with Apu. And if you watched
the episode...
Oh,
yeah, and Mr. Hankey left at the end.
Yes. Maybe they called it. They called it. I can't... I don't know why no one else is pointing this out. They totally called it.
Did they call it, or did they hear inner industry whispers about what was going to happen?
I know they make that. I know they make the episode super fast, so it could be either way, but... now that I know that they're like, I was like, I need to go rewatch the episode now of South Park, because in my head, now that they've announced this weekend, I'm like, damn, I need to rewatch that episode, because I bet there's a whole nother commentary in the episode now that I missed.
Yeah, it definitely makes that episode a lot better. It makes it a lot better in retrospect.
Yeah, yeah.
All right, but when we're talking about art and we're saying the way these things affect our lives and we're talking about a mind-body dichotomy, that's why we have the final segment on our show, is applying all of these things we talk about and saying, how do they affect our specific and personal lives, individual lives? Let's head into it in Life on the Midside. Take a good look around. Does life really suck? Are we just complaining? I hope that this mic is on. Because I'm on a roll here. I hope this is making some sense. I hope that you'll throw up your hands and sing it and tell all the haters that they should just shut up and smile. Yeah. This week we actually have a listener submission for the segment. We actually got a couple. So, Midsiders out there, listeners out there, thank you for submitting. I love that. And if you want to continue to submit, you can find the contact information on themidside.com. You just go to themidside.com, go to the index, go to contact. You can send stuff that way. You can send it via our Facebook page, via our Twitter. You can send it to me on Facebook personally. Or, William, where else can you do it?
You can do it on Discord. Everyone can join Discord. It's a link at the bottom of the show notes for every episode. So just go to themidside.com/podcast. You can see it there. I also occasionally post it on my Facebook. But once you join, you get access to a bunch of channels where we have discussions. And if you're a Patreon supporter, you can link your Patreon account to Discord and you get access to our super secret channels for Patreon-only subscribers, including a voice channel.
All right, William, so I'm going to read this submission. It's a little long, and then I think you can go first on this one because I know you did a little bit of a podcast with Jason Stotts. You had a few episodes on a sex podcast, and that's kind of what this one's about. So,
all right.
Justin, I have a topic that's very personal to me that I would like to talk about or perhaps bring up on Life on the Midside. You touched on it briefly a few times, casual sex. I understand that sleeping with people indiscriminately is terrible for you in the long run, but I don't see what's wrong with sleeping with someone who does have some positive values, just not enough that you'd want to pursue a long-term relationship with them. The relationship can still have meaning, but should be broken once someone in it has found someone better who they do want to spend more of their time with. Can man not just experience one of the greatest joys of existence while he is searching for someone he actually wants to be with on a long-term basis? Would doing this really make the relationship he wants less meaningful once he achieves it? Because this whole part of objectivist comes across as if it's my old faith preaching abstinence until you get married, I cannot identify the contradiction that I may have, which is making me view sex this way. So the questions, again, to go back. Can man not just experience one of the greatest joys of existence while he is searching for someone he actually wants to be with on a long-term basis? Would doing this really make the relationship he wants less meaningful once he achieves it?
All right, so yeah, we need to unpack this a bit. I think my journey sounds very similar to this person's, this listener's journey. You know, I had a very religious upbringing, and of course, on top of that, I was, you know, gay and dealing, figuring that out about myself. I think that because sex is separated from emotion in religion and to a large extent in our culture, like casual sex is just another way to split the mind and the body. It can be a struggle to figure out what is the right way to engage and integrate those two. So let's start with the principle. Hey, if you share a deep value or even a medium deep value with someone and you want to have sex with them, if you understand yourself and your what that means to you, I think that that's perfectly healthy. Now, let's contrast that with what most people mean by casual sex, especially like in the gay community. I can open up Grindr right now and get 3 dick pics sent to me, right? And people just wanting a random hookup, right? That is not healthy. Right. So that's the one category. And obviously the ideal is you meet someone, you go on a date, you hit it off, you start building those connections, and physical intimacy is one of those connections that build up. Where people get into the problem is in the middle, when you're still trying to figure out if this is a long-term relationship potential. And I think that exploring sex, exploring that physical intimacy with people is okay, right? If you're feeling guilt about that, then it's time to think about, do some introspection and see what it is that you are really looking for. Physical intimacy as an end to itself is probably not healthy, right? What, in order to do that, at least for me, like, in my observations, people have to project things onto people, right? When you see someone who looks attractive to you and you think, oh, you know, maybe I would want to, you know, be intimate with that person, I think that a lot of that is your emotion, your mind projecting the qualities that you want in that person. And so I think it's okay, as you're figuring out who this person is, if you want to get physically intimate. I think that's fine. I think that the moment, though, that you realize that this doesn't have that this isn't going to go anywhere, then you have to be very careful, because your mind and your body are integrated. They go both ways. If you continually have sex with a casual partner, you're going to develop emotional connection to them. That, now, maybe that leads to a relationship, right? But if that person's not interested in a long-term relationship and you're not interested in a long-term relationship, it could hold you back.
100%. I think the key word that you honed in on there is casual. And I think that's the first premise I would blow up here. And it's the premise of what does it mean to have casual sex, as you just talked about very well. And the other thing I would add to the discussion you just had is just approach it the way you approach anything in life. Don't do anything unless you've taken it seriously and thought about how it affects your life and how it adds to your life. That's what William's talking about, is the way people engage in casual sex. It's so casual that it's harming their life.
Yeah.
So only participate and only bring someone into your life if it's going to add to your life. And even if in the short term, it's going to add to your life. Usually casual sex for people only adds in the extreme short term, in that however long period of time they're having the sex is when it adds. So you have to look beyond that to how it adds to your life, what you're building as a life overall. What is the integrated whole you're building?
Yeah. And I would also add, though, it's totally fine if you're not sure what you want in a partner yet to engage in casual relationships, because into your integrated, into your overall goal. Because I certainly had more casual, quote unquote. I agree with you. I don't like that term either. I had a lot more sex with people who I'd only met a few times or only had, you know, weeks of interactions with, while I was still figuring out what I wanted in a partner. Because guess what? Part of figuring out what you want in a partner is the physical intimacy. What kind of physical intimacy are you looking for? And your ability to communicate those things. So I think it's, I think we have to remove the guilt associated with it and assign it to the if you treat sex like food, you're doing it wrong.
Right. And that's, William, where I was going. Thank you for, you jumped ahead of me of where I was going with the second premise I was about to blow up. But too many people treat sex like you have to know the end when you're at the beginning. And that's exactly what is being said here when you say, when the question is, would doing this really make the relationship he wants less meaningful once he achieves it? What's the first question? Oh, yeah. Can man not just experience one of the greatest joys of existence while he is searching for someone he actually wants to be with on a long-term basis? Now, I'm going to read that question again. Can man not just experience one of the greatest joys of existence while he is searching for someone he actually wants to be with on a long-term basis? Why are you making that decision so quickly? Why is everything about seeing the end goal and seeing what the last point is? Do you know the future? Do you know what's going to happen? Do you take a job and you know if the job is going to be your job for the rest of your life or for 2 weeks? No. So why would sex are you treating it that way? Why would romantic relationships are you taking it that way? Why don't you just spend time with someone you enjoy and let it develop naturally? Now, tell them what your goals are and what your values are, and what you want out of a relationship, but let that develop naturally and experience it in the moment. As long as you're not doing things that are self-destructive, you can enjoy things in the moment and also work towards where you're going, because that's what life is.
And that's also how you figure it out. That's also how you figure it out, right? Like you can't figure out what you like without experimenting a bit and making a few mistakes. And I'll share one little personal anecdote. Back when I lived in Baltimore, I went to a Halloween party
So that was your mistake, living in Baltimore?
Yeah, that was my mistake. I went to a Halloween party, met a coworker of one of my close friends. We went out. We ended up talking the whole night, right? The whole night. People actually took a picture of us because we went to get drinks and we didn't come back till a half hour later because we were just chatting and laughing and having a good time. We ended up hooking up that night. And the next day, he felt super guilty because he was like, damn, I just hooked up with one of my friend's best friends and like a Halloween party, like so cliche, right? Like, you know, I'm a terrible person. But he saw me on the other hand saying like, I was like, oh, this is great. Like we had a real connection, you know, like I'm okay. You know, I'm okay if this was it, but like, hey, if you want to like date, like we should totally date. I feel like we have a lot, you know, a lot of values to share. And we actually ended up dating for like 2 years. Like, and if you carry around that guilt and apprehension about like exploring physical intimacy in the moment, I would have never had that very healthy 2 year relationship.
Well said. I think that's a good way to sum up this segment, William. So let's sum up this episode then. What did we learn this trip, William?
I learned that, that there are other people out there that struggle with what it means to have a healthy sex life. And I want everyone to know that we all deal with those issues and that talking about it is the best way to work through it.
The more you know.
Dun, dun, dun.
Thanks for the PSA, William.
Justin, what did you learn?
I learned that if there is a problem in your life, all you have to do is create an app and automatically it is fixed. If your life is shitty, make an app and it will be fixed. This concludes your journey into the midside. I'm Justin M. Mazeski reminding you that if things get tough, take a step back and witness the farce.
Have a day.